Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Without further ado, grab yourself a cup of coffee and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Dave, how are you doing down there?
We're doing all right down here. We're hanging in there. How are you guys doing up there?
We're doing all right. We're both back to work, and
that's good.
My hospital is trying to be just emergency cases.
Yeah.
The specialties are there in terms of being able to consult and being able to see patients that come through the ER. You know, like if it's an ophtho emergency, ophtho takes that case. If it's an exotic, ZCAM takes that case. So that definitely helps a lot. But I feel like our caseload coming through the ER is still, it might be 10% lower, but it's still pretty high.
Yeah. So, well, and that's got to be impacted by, you know, it's a different landscape. We're doing things a lot differently than we used to. So the whole check-in procedure and the contact with the owner, all that's different. So all that has to take time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have one designated person that goes to every car for every triage on every shift and, you know, trying to keep a minimum staff. And it's difficult because our caseload is still really high, especially in the ER. Maybe not necessarily in the hospitalized patients, but in the ER, the caseload is still really high. And so it's really tough balance. But the university is being very proactive, which is really good to see. And every day, as it's been, as we've talked about, it's changing. They're trying to make it better and better. And, you know, one cool thing or maybe kind of terrifying thing to think about at the same time, you know, our Tufts donated a total of 4 ventilators, 2 from our clinic and 2 from a satellite clinic. To Tufts Medical Center in Boston, and we got word that 3 out of the 4 either are in use or have been used for human patients. So very cool that they are actually being used. Also kind of like, I don't know if I want them back now.
There's that. I was just going to ask you, like, is there a protocol yet for how we clean these things when we get them back?
I don't know. I'm sure. I can only imagine, given that these hospitals reuse these things on the reg. And, you know, not even just for COVID-19, but for infectious pneumonias and different things. So I'm sure there is a very detailed cleaning protocol. So I'm really not that concerned about it, but it is, I will admit it is in the back of my mind.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully it's one of those things where, you know, if you let somebody borrow something, hopefully you're going to get it back in a clean and working order. Like, here it is. It was just on a COVID patient. Now it's yours again. Hopefully they'll do some type of cleaning on it before they send it back to you.
So this is another episode where we recorded on one day and we're recording an intro on a separate day because we kind of thought the situation is so dynamic would be very different than what we talked about in the intro if we recorded at the same time. Let's see, we recorded this episode, about a week ago? So, you know, in terms of case counts and things, it is definitely different, but I don't know if it's necessarily as scary as I thought it would be in terms of, you know, the numbers being much, much higher.
Yeah.
But it is still, you know,
I mean, the numbers are higher, the numbers are growing, but
you're absolutely right.
Nothing drastically different has changed. Like, it's not, we're kind of in the same spot we were when we recorded this episode originally. It's just that the numbers are higher now.
Yeah. I am starting to see, and we looked for it this morning and I couldn't find what I had read, but I am starting to see maybe some encouraging news with, you know, not necessarily declines, but maybe leveling off of numbers of ICU hospitalizations in some of those very affected states like California and New York. And when I read the article, it was the first day that had happened, so it wasn't enough to establish a trend yet. So that bears watching to see if that if that continues. That would be fantastic. So, you know, as with anything, you know, just trying to find any little bit of good news.
Also, Jeff, in this episode, we kind of break from protocol just a little bit. The majority of our episodes, we talk about issues that are facing technicians, like the VNI and compassion fatigue and suicide thoughts and all those other things that kind of really impact us as technicians, really leaving the medical part out of it. But I feel like with this episode, it was really important to talk to Noah because he is on the front lines. He is dealing with these COVID patients. patients, and you know, he's a super smart guy, but he kind of dove into the medical aspect of it, of right. exactly what's happening and how these things are working, which is, I think, is really, it was a really great discussion. I learned a whole lot just talking to him.
Absolutely. You know, we talk a lot about ventilator settings and ARMSnet and some of those things, and ECMO, and some really, really cool stuff. So you can get your nerd on in this episode for sure. But I think, you know, given what is going on in the world right now, our last two episodes, both with Tiffany Bali, who is both an RVT and now mostly an RN, and with Noah, without the current landscape, I don't know that we would have had either of these episodes. I think that, you know, what's going on kind of not necessarily dictated that, but it was like a great opportunity to get additional insight that maybe we wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So, you know, it is definitely a little bit out of the norm for what we normally do, but it so applies. And we do talk a little bit about how, you know, maybe he deals with some of this stuff that's going on, and we do try to tie some of that stuff in too. So, you know, it is a little bit different, but it's a little bit of a different world that we're living in right now.
Definitely.
And we're going to take next week off, and that we won't have an episode releasing next week. And then
we're not exactly taking next week off. We are still recording too.
This is true. And then the week after, so 2 weeks from today, we'll have another episode, and we will have episodes again on back-to-back weekends. And then starting the first Sunday in May, we'll get back to our normal every other week schedule. Yep. So a little bit of a different schedule through April, but it's a little bit of a different world right now. So,
and we should introduce what we're going to be doing for the month of May.
Yeah, absolutely.
The month of May is going to be Mental Health Awareness Month. So we are going to have guests on talking about mental health. We're going to be talking about compassion fatigue,
depression.
What else do we have lined up?
And then we have somebody that's also going to talk from like more of a management side about how to kind of employ some of these things, or spot some of these things in clinic, and how to implement things to kind of help with that. So we're going to take it from a couple of different angles. We're going to let some people share their stories, and it's going to be probably a little bit eye-opening, probably quite a bit sad, but it's going to be very real. And
I think it's really important too.
It's really important. And I know that there are people that are going to listen that are going to say to themselves, this is exactly where I'm at.
Exactly, yeah.
And hopefully they can learn some things, get some advice, get some ideas on how to look inward and start to make changes that will impact not just their career and their professional life, but themselves, that they can start to make themselves heal. And because these are big, big problems in our profession right now. And so the month of May, those episodes are really going to be probably a bit heavy, but I think they're very, very necessary. Exactly. Yeah. So,
well, and that's one of the things that when we started the idea with this podcast is talking about things that are going to be really impactful, and like we said earlier, not medical, not clinical, but more looking at ourselves as opposed to looking at our patients in these episodes. And I think that's exactly what we're going to do with these episodes.
Yeah. So for the month of May, when you listen with your cup of coffee, maybe have a Kleenex box nearby too, and not just listen to the stories, but see if you can identify any of those things in yourselves or in your coworkers, and try to make your environment and where you are a better place as well. And hopefully people can find some really good healing and some really good ideas on how to deal with some of this stuff.
Well, and especially with what we're all dealing with right now is, you know, the changes in protocols and the risk of contracting this and the risks that we put ourselves into. You know, some of this is going to take a toll mentally, and you know, you can have negative impacts with everything that we're dealing with, and trying to get through that is going to be really important at this stage of the game.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, what do you think? Should we go ahead and jump into today's episode?
Let's jump on into it.
All right. Everybody, enjoy the episode. And from the Vet Tech Cafe, we hope you're well. We hope you're safe. Happy Easter, and have a good one. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, we got an awesome guest today.
Yes,
what do you think? You ready? Ready to get started?
I think so. Yeah, we're still in the cafe. We're still takeout only. Nobody's sitting in the cafe anymore.
Right.
Actually, our guest has told us that he's sitting in the outside portion of our cafe,
he's out on the patio.
I guess we'll allow that.
Yeah. So today we have with us Noah Jones, and I'm going to say all these letters first, and then I'll say all the words after. But he is a BSRT, RRT, ACCS, RCP, RVT, I know that one for sure. And VTS, research anesthetist. So the BSRT is Bachelor of Science in Respiratory Therapy, which he got at University of North Carolina at UNC Charlotte. The RRT ACCS is Registered Respiratory Therapist and Adult Critical Care Specialist. And the RCP is the... I lost that one. Dave, do you remember that one?
Respiratory Care Practitioner.
Respiratory Care Practitioner, yes. And the RVT, Registered Veterinary Technician, and the Veterinary Technician Specialist. So he currently works at Mission Memorial Hospital, which is a regional level one trauma and chest pain center in North Carolina. And is also the owner and lead consultant of Foundation Veterinary Solutions, which provides anesthesia and critical care consultation, training, and staff development support at several veterinary hospitals throughout the country. And then also the VTS and lab animal medicine and research anesthetist. So Noah, thank you so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. I know you're a very busy man. You got a lot going on right now. But can we get you a cup of coffee? It is early on a Friday morning. How would you like it?
Yes, absolutely. I'm an espresso guy myself, actually. but right now I just got a nice strong cup with some half and half in it. So that
there
would
you
be
go.
Great.
Nice.
Somebody that drinks coffee like I do. Jeff, what are you drinking today? Hopefully
well,
not something
know,
terrible.
No, I know you'll be happy. I squeezed one more cup out of my bag of bourbon pecan.
Awesome.
So yeah. So, and you got your black silk going, iced, I'm guessing.
Yes. It's not a, I know the last time we recorded, it was like 90 degrees and today it's a little colder. It's down in the 50s, but it's still early on. It might warm up a little bit, but yeah, I'm the New Englander in me still has my iced coffee going.
Yeah, well, it's still 45 and raining up here. So, Noah, if you don't mind, as we always kind of start out, we have people kind of describe their career path and then we kind of jump off from there. So if you would take a few minutes and kind of talk to us about, you know, starting out as an RVT and moving into the human world.
Yeah, I started my career, I guess, in California just as a veterinary assistant.
What part of California?
I grew up in Sacramento.
Okay.
And studied biology up at Humboldt State, Northern California.
Okay, yeah.
And after school there, went back down to Sacramento and just responded to a newspaper ad looking for veterinary assistants at a little GP practice, GP emergency practice, and applied and got the job. So started off doing mostly kennel stuff and then kind of slowly worked my way up there and began doing some overnight emergency stuff there and fell in love with that, as I'm sure y'all can relate.
Yep.
And then moved around to a couple different hospitals and eventually utilized the alternate route program in California, which for those listeners that aren't aware, it's after you have X amount of hours of experience and X amount of hours of education in specific subjects and X amount of hours in continuing education, they allow you to sit for the California board exam, which of course I think California now actually utilizes the VTNE.
Correct. Yes.
Got my RVT and was working in emergency critical care in California and really enjoyed working with respiratory patients, in particular mechanical ventilator patients, and so sought additional education initially just through continuing education programs for that. We relocated to North Carolina in 2012 to be a little bit closer to some of my wife's family out here. And when we moved out here, I told my wife, you know, I'm thinking about going back to school for respiratory therapy, initially not necessarily to move into the human field, really just to go to school for the knowledge of the pulmonary physiology and ventilator management so that I could utilize that in the veterinary world. So that's what I did at first. And I got my AS at school in Western North Carolina here, Southwestern Community College. And after that, finished my BS at UNC Charlotte. And inevitably did start working some in human medicine and have kind of slowly over the last several years moved to, I'm now full-time at the human hospital here in town and haven't done a whole lot of clinical work recently at the veterinary hospital for any number of reasons with small animal patients. Have been doing mostly lab animal stuff over the last couple of years, but still doing, like you guys mentioned earlier, some consultation stuff and some education stuff at a few different clinics all over the place. Mostly what I do in the clinical world right now for veterinary medicine is folks will call me or text me or send me a picture of some patient that's sick as hell that they got, and they're going, what do you think about this? And kind of just give my two cents and hopefully try and help some people out.
when you say they're sending you text or information for advice, are those like small animal or is it lab animal?
No, so small animal patients, the lab animal stuff, I typically will travel around I'm involved with a couple different private companies that I will do some work with, either remotely helping them with IACUC protocols or anesthesia protocols for their cases, or will travel and run cases for them, at least initially while we iron out the protocol. And then typically once we get the protocol well established and kind of work out the kinks, they usually will use somebody locally who is, you know, certainly more than competent in managing the anesthesia. And once we iron out kind of the details and submit the protocol to the review committee. So
what exactly led you to decide that you were going to shift from animal care to the human world? What was the driving force for that?
Well, to be honest, it's mostly that the local emergency referral centers here in town didn't have very active or strong mechanical ventilation programs. So we certainly have a mechanical ventilator at the place in town here, and we have a program in place with protocols, but either because the clinicians on duty weren't super comfortable with putting a patient on the mechanical ventilator, or the owners, you know, didn't want to pursue it or couldn't afford it or whatever the case is, we just didn't have mechanical ventilation cases all that often, which I'm sure a lot of clinics can relate to. You know, really, unless you're at a big center or certainly at a university, you know, you're not usually putting that many cases on the ventilator. So I wanted to continue to be exposed to that and hone my skills. And, you know, certainly in the human field as a respiratory therapist, you know, that's what we do all day, every day. So I wanted to keep those skills up. So I now work full time doing that. And what a lot of people in both the human field and the veterinary field don't always realize is that we use pretty much the exact same machines and the exact same settings and really the exact same protocols with small animal species and with humans. So the majority of what we do in a critical care setting in the human field almost directly translates to what we would do in a critical care setting in the veterinary field. Obviously some of the techniques and the anatomy and things like that will be different, but a lot of the physiology and the physics of what we're doing and the reasons why we're doing it are the same across multiple species. So the stuff that I am privileged to do in the human field, I then can utilize in the veterinary cases that either I'm working with or that I'm helping people work with.
Well, it seems like that's statement is kind of highlighted by the fact that I know Jeff, you were saying that Tufts was sending some of their ventilators off to the local hospital. So obviously the ventilators are going to be exactly the same. You know, obviously the other than the differences between the anatomy and some of the physiology, obviously most of that is going to be pretty much exactly the same. Is that correct?
Pretty translatable, I guess. Yeah. Cool. So obviously, Noah, like COVID-19 right now is a huge, you know, obviously a global pandemic and cases are going up every day. How does that look at the hospital you're working at? Are you seeing a lot of those kinds of cases already, or is North Carolina not too high in cases so far?
The total number of cases in North Carolina right now, I believe we had at least, and you know, obviously every day we get more, but I believe most recently it was right around 3,000 cases in North Carolina.
Okay.
Up this way, I want to say we had around 100 confirmed cases, but there's such a lag in testing right now for any number of different reasons that we have, I don't know, probably 100 tests that are still pending on patients. So, you know, that number continues to go up every day, and it's not necessarily that on that particular day you had X number of patients come into the hospital that were diagnosed with it. It's really more like last week we submitted these tests, and those tests are finally back.
Yeah.
Those numbers are being added. So we're the numbers in general are lagging probably, I'd say, on average, a week behind what's actually happening right. in a clinical setting. So I think right now in our hospital, I believe we have two or three confirmed cases currently hospitalized, but we probably have 50, 60, 70 patients in the hospital that all have pending tests. As you guys probably know, and many of the listeners probably know, that the testing is fraught with problems. The test they use, it's a nasal swab, and it's a real-time PCR that they use. And real-time PCRs, you know, they're great. There's very few false positives, but they're, you know, notorious for having a significant number of false negatives. So even if we get a negative test, we're still treating the patient as positive just in case, because you never know.
So, and as a respiratory therapist, is that kind of your role right now? Are you directly working with these COVID patients?
We are trying to minimize exposure, certainly. So a lot of the things we would normally do, for example, medicated aerosol therapy, things like nebulizers for bronchodilators and things like that. That's our bread and butter with, you know, non-critically ill patients who are just, you know, have mild to moderate disease. Unfortunately, that, you know, aerosol therapy generates aerosol. and that presents some infection control barriers, in particular with these patients. So we are limiting our use of aerosol therapy with COVID patients because we don't want to generate more aerosol than is already being generated by the patients, which can increase staff exposure and certainly would pose a infection control risk for other patients. So we're really not doing a whole lot with the mild to moderately diseased patients. They're in the hospital. We typically will assess them, you know, at least Q shift, but we're trying not to go in the rooms if we can help it. If the patients are requiring bronchodilator therapy, we're typically using multi-dose inhalers, you know, like albuterol inhalers or ipratropium inhalers. If the patient is able to self-administer, we're even just leaving the medicines in the room and having the patient administer the medicines to themselves. We'll pop in the doorway and say, "Hey, did you take your inhaler?" Say yes, and we say, "Okay, great." So just because we're trying to avoid having to go in these rooms, if at all possible. So if we need to go in the room because the patient's more sick or is incapacitated in any way, then obviously we're using appropriate PPE and going in the room and doing what we need to do.
Sure. Are you finding or do you have any personal experience or have heard anything? Is it any more difficult in terms of maybe the level of settings that you have to use to ventilate these kinds of patients versus other, say, nonspecific pneumonias or other pulmonary cases? Are you having to do anything vastly different that in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, what COVID-19 appears to be causing is obviously there's the mild disease is just related to the virus going in and directly attacking the epithelium in the pulmonary system. So it's going to cause a bronchitis or a bronchiolitis where you'll have, you know, mucus production and certainly irritation and inflammation. And that can lead to, that's what causes the initial cough and sputum production and things like that. So that stuff is usually can be managed without needing to put them on any kind of mechanical ventilation or significant respiratory support. If the infection becomes severe and the viral load is high, what ends up happening is like a cytokine storm. So the virus is attacking cells. Those cells then lyse and release inflammatory mediators. If enough of those cells lyse, those inflammatory mediators can travel to throughout the body into distant organs, which will then attack those organs, and you get multi-organ failure and a cytokine storm, and that leads to the acute respiratory distress syndrome that we're seeing in the most severe patients. So in those patients, we are instituting high-level respiratory support. Typically, we're avoiding anything in between conventional oxygen therapy. Initially, we were just going straight to endotracheal intubation if they weren't able to be maintained on, you know, a traditional nasal cannula. Usually, we would go in a stepwise fashion and try, you know, higher flow nasal cannulas or non-invasive mask ventilation, things like that. But there's significant concern that those modalities generate additional aerosols and can increase staff exposure and actually increase the spread of the virus in the healthcare facility. So they were going straight from traditional oxygen therapy to securing an airway and instituting endotracheal intubation and mechanical ventilation. Since there's a shortage of ventilators and ICU beds for those types of patients, we're now laxing a little bit on that, and if we think we can maintain the patient on a high-flow nasal cannula or non-invasive ventilation, we are putting some patients on those modalities, but for the most part, if we see a downward trajectory in the patient status, we're just moving straight to putting them on the ventilator. And yeah, we're using traditional ARDSnet strategies for mechanical ventilation. The ARDSnet trial, of course, from back in the early 2000s, where they decided that low tidal volume ventilation and higher levels of positive end expiratory pressure is ideal to improve survival. So that's pretty much what we're doing with these patients. It's nothing too special as far as settings goes. It's just lung protective ventilation and early positioning to optimize ventilation and oxygenation.
Gotcha. And is the mechanical ventilation, is this solely, that be solely for hypoxemia, or are there gas exchange problems with this as well where their CO2 levels are high also?
Yeah, typically what we're seeing is a classic, when we get blood gases on these patients, we're typically seeing the classic hypoxemic blood gas, which is, you know, a respiratory alkalosis. They're blowing off all kinds of CO2 because they're huffing and puffing, trying to get their oxygen levels up. So their CO2s are typically low. The pH is typically on the higher side, unless they have a concomitant metabolic acidosis, but profound hypoxemia. So if we can manage the hypoxemia without endotracheal intubation, that's what we're trying to do just to conserve resources. But overall, like I said, if we're seeing, if they have severe hypoxemia that's refractory to conventional oxygen therapy, or we're seeing a downward trajectory in their status, we are, I guess, preemptively is maybe a little bit of a strong word, but preemptively intubating these patients to treat the hypoxemia. As they begin to tire out and begin to fatigue, we will see the CO2 start to climb just because they're getting tired and fatiguing. And as soon as we start to see that, we typically will just go ahead and intubate them.
No, this may be my lack of knowledge of human medicine. Ventilator cases that I've had in the veterinary world, my patients need to be heavily sedated. Is that the same case with humans? Are they sedated for all this procedure, or are they somewhat lucid and awake?
It's highly patient dependent.
Okay.
You know, some patients can be maintained with little to no sedation, and they're awake and writing on a pad to be able to communicate, and they're, you know, watching TV and that kind of thing. So usually if they're that sick, though, in order to minimize injurious breathing patterns, because, you know, these patients are puffing and chugging away, so we intubate them and they're still huffing and puffing and chugging away, and usually their respiratory drive is so high that they're actually breathing these large tidal volumes that we really would probably rather not them be breathing because of the potential for further lung injury related to high tidal volume volume trauma. Right. In those patients, we will initially heavily sedate them. If that's still not enough to capture them on the ventilator, we'll administer a neuromuscular blockade through a pharmacological paralysis and just completely take control of them on the ventilator. What they're finding with COVID-19 is unrelated to any blood gas abnormality. These patients are developing significant encephalopathy, and they're not sure if that's like a metabolic encephalopathy related to metabolic derangements, or if it's the virus directly working in the central nervous system causing an encephalopathy. But these patients typically become severely encephalopathic before we intubate them. So we're trying to minimize the amount of sedation we're giving them, only because the more sedation you give a patient, the more encephalopathic they can be when you try and take the sedation away. And that increases ICU delirium, and any increase in ICU delirium is going to worsen their outcome. So we're trying to minimize sedation. And there's certain sedatives that have been associated with higher levels of ICU delirium. You know, in particular, like midazolam, Versed, has been associated with higher levels of ICU delirium. So we're trying to minimize, utilizing midazolam in patients. So typically, these guys or these ladies are on, some combination of propofol, fentanyl, ketamine, dexmedetomidine, something, some combination of those and or all of them, whatever we need to be able to let them tolerate the endotracheal tube and not have them chugging away 40 breaths a minute on the ventilator.
Yeah.
Sure. So you mentioned in there ARDSnet. I know at Tufts, we've kind of just started to adopt, some of the higher PEEP, lower FiO2 and some of our more recent vent cases before we shipped them off to Tufts Medical School. Is that kind of ultimately where a lot of these patients end up at the higher PEEP and lower FiO2 type settings?
Target SpO2 is 92 to 96%, with
Okay.
a PO2 of at least 55 is what we're shooting for. So, normal PO2 being greater than 80, of course, but we're happy with
Right.
anything in that 55 to 70 range is what we're shooting for. And we're as low of an FiO2 as we can possibly get. So, higher PEEP levels typically starting in the 12 to 14 range, but these patients are often requiring 16, 18, 20 centimeters of water of PEEP. And then if that's still not enough, then we are going to be heavily sedating them and doing a neuromuscular blockade, like I said. Prone positioning has been shown to improve outcomes in patients with ARDS. So obviously the majority of time our veterinary patients are already in a prone position, that being
Right.
sternal recumbency. And that's because those people who've seen that paper, God, I don't even remember when that paper was published, but sternal recumbency was shown to provide the best gas exchange in dogs. I don't think they looked at it in cats, but in dogs at least, that sternal recumbency showed the optimal gas exchange. And it's the same thing in humans. Prone positioning optimizes gas exchange in ARDS. So we'll prone them typically for 12 to 16 hours a day. And then if that's still not enough, we'll give them inhaled pulmonary vasodilators. So that's things like inhaled nitric oxide or inhaled epoprostenol, and that's just to improve ventilation perfusion matching and improve blood flow through the lungs. And if that's still not enough, then we move towards extracorporeal support, being putting them, like on a heart-lung bypass machine, ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, to oxygenate them that way. But the literature on that is not great. So typically, once they get to that point, the prognosis is very poor, at least, according to the literature. That there's not a ton of data out for COVID, of course, on it yet,
Sure,
but
sure.
the other component is usually once they're getting that sick, typically the disease progression is cough, increasing respiratory symptoms, hypoxemia, respiratory failure, and then they typically will show a initial improvement after you intubate them. But then some of these patients are developing a very severe viral myocarditis, and they go into fulminant heart failure. And those are the patients that are typically requiring high levels of vasopressors or extracorporeal support via ECMO. And once they get to that point, I'm not aware of any patients once they get to that point that have survived. Once they develop that severe heart failure, the heart just kind of stops working, and they don't really know why yet. They aren't sure if it's, again, if it's the virus directly attacking the myocardium, or if it's, the cytokine storm that's causing heart damage. They're not exactly sure yet.
Gotcha. Is ECMO pretty, is that, can most hospitals that are treating these patients, like if they're able to do mechanical ventilation, are they, if they need to move up with their level of care, are most hospitals able to provide ECMO, or is that still pretty few and far between in terms of hospitals that can do that?
It's becoming more widespread, but it's mostly tertiary care facilities that have that capability. We have an ECMO program. It's certainly not as active as other hospitals in North Carolina, Duke and CMC and things, further east, but we're the only hospital in the western part of the state that has an ECMO program. So we have that capability at our hospital. They're very selective with the patients that they will choose to put on that, because again, once a patient gets to that point, they're typically very, very, very ill, and it's such a resource intensive procedure. You know, usually it's requiring two dedicated nurses, plus a perfusionist, a respiratory therapist, and a physician at the bedside almost all day. And so,
right,
especially as this ramps up, I don't know that we're going to have staffing to do that with all that many patients. So they're pretty selective with who they put on that. Most of the time when we're putting patients on ECMO, it's for a bridge to like a heart transplant or something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No, so just, I mean, I'm just thinking now that you're like involved in these patients and being exposed to these things. So what type of protection are you, like when you leave work, what do you do? Do they have like one of those like decontamination showers as you're leaving the building, or what's the protocol for not bringing this home to, like, I know you're a husband and a father. What's your protocol for not bringing this home to your family?
My wife doesn't let me come home. No, I mean,
that's why you're outside, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no joke. No, I mean, it's definitely a concern. It's certainly not as, you know, things like Ebola, very, very contagious, spread by any type of bodily fluid and can be aerosolized. And so things like Ebola is where you're in your full dress out Tyvek PPE with a respirator, things like that. And you have to go through the decontamination shower and you have a spotter to make sure you're, you know, not contaminating yourself as you take things off and all of that stuff. So it's not currently what the World Health Organization and the CDC are recommending, is not protections to that level. Now, I will say I don't necessarily agree with everything the CDC has come out with as far as recommended protections. You know, they were initially recommending full dress out and respirators dealing with any patient, but I think they've changed their recommendations not because they have solid science, but mostly just because there's such a shortage of PPE. So
right,
current,
right, you have to adapt.
So exactly. So currently, what they're recommending is what we call droplet precautions with any patient that you're suspecting or that is confirmed to have COVID. And droplet precautions are essentially a gown to prevent contact fomite transmission on your clothes, and a mask to prevent droplet transmission onto your mucous membranes, and a face shield, just a standard level 3 surgical mask that's fluid barrier resistant, and gloves, of course, and a hairnet. Now, they are recommending for any aerosol generating procedure, you know, and I'm you can't see my fingers, but they're quoting, aerosol generating procedure, and really what the examples they give of those are things like endotracheal intubation, giving nebulizer therapy, aerosol therapy, non-invasive ventilation, things like that that are known to generate aerosols in the immediate environment of the patient. So for those particular procedures and instances, they are recommending N95 respirators or what we call PAPRs, which is positive air purifying respirators. So they're essentially like, those are the hoods that you see with the tubes attached with the pump that's pumping air into the little hood.
Right. Right.
So they recommend those for those procedures. But, you know, anytime these patients cough, they're theoretically generating aerosol. So I think that, you know, what I've been recommending to my colleagues and what I personally have been doing is I've been wearing an N95 respirator all day long, just because A, you don't know who's coming in, who has the disease. It's taking, you know, weeks to get the testing back. So by the time you get the testing back, it's too late. You've already exposed yourself anyway. So,
right.
So I've just been wearing that all day long and just trying to be extra safe. You know, we have scrubs that we can change into at the hospital and change out of, but either before we go home, or I'll change in the garage at home and just go straight into the shower, you know, before I even, you know, say hey to the kids or hey to my wife. So yeah. Just trying to be extra careful with trying not to bring anything home that I don't have to bring home.
Right.
And, you know, leaving anything in the garage that I can leave in the garage. So, you know, I'm driving my car to work. Anything that we're going to the grocery store or doing with the kids, we're using the other car. The nice thing is that the virus really only lives probably for a maximum of 2 to 3 days on any surface. So if you leave something sit for a couple few days, the virus is going to die on it anyways, especially with some of the PPE stuff where, you know, I utilize the same respirator and just cycle cycle through a few different ones, and just I'll use it for one day, then let it sit for a couple days, and then I'll reuse the same respirator a couple days later, because by then the virus has died on it. So
gotcha. You know, one of the things I know, you know, I do have a few friends sprinkled throughout the country that are in human medicine that I've chatted with about this, and one thing, and even in veterinary medicine with all the changes that hospitals are instituting, it's a lot of stress on the staff, a lot of worry and everything out there. What kind of things do you do outside a hospital, like on your days off, to kind of keep your sanity and like just be able to deal with it? Or is that not too big of an issue for you?
No, it's definitely been, dealing with this level of acuity of patients is nothing new. I mean, that's what we do every day. So the acuity isn't necessarily anything new. Now, the sheer number of cases that certainly some areas in the country are seeing, we're not seeing here yet. Our cases aren't expected to peak until the middle or the end of April. So I think we have a couple weeks, and the hospital's been doing a great job with preparing and trying to accumulate resources and supplies in to prepare for the influx of patients that we're expecting to see, hoping not to see, realistically expecting to see. So certainly other places in the country, that's really the bigger issues, is the sheer number of the high acuity patients that they're seeing. So, but overall, the biggest stressor for me has been the PPE thing, just because, you know, again, I certainly not necessarily pointing the finger at the hospital or even the CDC. I get the reason why they have the recommendation for the PPE that they do, because they're trying to conserve PPE. But from a healthcare provider standpoint, it's insufficient to just wear a mask with these patients, because the reality is that they're aerosolizing. I don't want to say all the time, but, you know, the only time they're aerosolizing isn't when we're intubating them, you know. So so that's been the most stressful thing, is just trying to stay safe and worrying about, you know, the family and certainly, you know, my colleagues. So the kids have been home, of course, which is both a stress reliever at times and an additional stressor. So we're trying to, you know, all the schools have been, you know, sending work home and doing a homeschooling type of thing. So that's kind of stressful. But overall, just trying to spend time with the kids and be outside in the yard and go for walks and hang with the dog and the cat. And I'm a cyclist, so I've been trying to do as much. We have an indoor cycle. We do the Peloton thing. So we try and do that, both my wife and I, to stay sane, and yoga and mindfulness and eating healthy and, you know, all those types of things is really what I've been trying to stick with. Lots of coffee.
Well, thank you for keeping the kids.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, somebody's got to pay our bills, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We kind of didn't want to do an entire episode on talking about clinical stuff, because that's not really the goal of our podcast. However, I feel like this is very valuable information. You know, the nerd in me is loving this entire conversation, and I hope our listeners are listening in and being entertained by this as well. Just in terms of getting you back into the veterinary world, what parallels do you see between being a respiratory therapist and being an RVT? Like, what similarities do you see in what you're doing now versus what you were doing as a technician?
So a lot of veterinary technicians, as the listeners know, are jacks of all trades. So that's the one dissimilarity, I guess, between human medicine and veterinary medicine that I think often gets highlighted, especially when we're in this conversation of credentialing and veterinary nurse versus veterinary technician. And, you know, the mantra tends to be, well, we're more than just nurses, you know, we're radiology technicians and phlebotomists and respiratory therapists and anesthetists and all of those things. So that's often the dissimilarity. But from a respiratory therapist standpoint, a lot of the things that I do on a daily basis are the same things that I'd be doing with the same types of cases as a veterinary technician. You know, you're helping to, you know, monitor the patient and maintain homeostasis and watching for trends and administering medications and informing the physician, or, you know, in the veterinary technician's case, the veterinarian, as changes in patient status and working out care plans with them. And so really, I always struggle with, we want to, in veterinary medicine, we want to be viewed, or I guess respected, as equal counterparts to our human colleagues until it comes to the conversation of what we call ourselves, and then we're so much greater because we do so many more things. So, right. I think we, as a veterinary profession, really are more similar than we want to acknowledge. You know, the nursing staff certainly do more than just nursing. You know, there's nurses, they're a lot more specialized in human medicine. So you might have a wound care nurse, or you might have a pulmonary nurse, or you might have a cardiac nurse, or you might have a nurse that does endoscopy, or a nurse that works in the OR. So you have nurses that are jacks of all trades as well. They tend to be very specialized, and anybody that's worked in a university environment or a large specialty referral center, it's very similar. I mean, you have veterinary technicians that will be very specialized in a specific department, hence the VTS revolution that's happened over the last 10, 20 years. So it's very similar. And so while, yes, I agree, veterinary technicians are certainly jacks of all trades, and we do all these different things, especially in, you know, smaller clinic general practice settings, but there's something to be said for really honing in and specializing and becoming an expert in a specific part of veterinary medicine. And I think that that model is something that is being deployed at more veterinary hospitals, more and more veterinary hospitals, and I think is working really, really well. Rather than having a veterinary technician that does everything, you have a bunch of veterinary technicians that all do very different specific things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a very good at it.
Yes. Yeah. In some ways, that's how the two professions are different, but at the same time, that's how they're very similar, I guess, if that makes any sense.
it does.
Absolutely. You know, we still see, you know, quite a few veterinary technicians for myriad reasons that ultimately make the leap to human nursing, whether it's pay or licensure or what have you. Having kind of gone through, you know, going from veterinary clinic into mostly in the human world now, what kind of advice would you give to somebody that's maybe looking to go back to school, whether it's human nursing or respiratory therapy or any other kind of subspecialty in the human world? Do you have any advice for anybody having gone through that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, as with anything, I mean, you got to do what you got to do to certainly make ends meet and live the life that you want to live. So when I say don't do anything for the money, of course, you got to do some things for the money. But I guess my advice would be, don't have that be the main driving force for a career change or wanting to get into human medicine. I guess when I transitioned to respiratory therapy and was a new respiratory therapist, I was making more money working at the veterinary clinic, you know, just because I had, you know, more veterinary experience and had been working in veterinary medicine for longer. You know, as everybody knows, the longer you're in the field, the more experience you have, the better compensated you hopefully are at your clinic. So initially I was not making more money as a respiratory therapist, and I still am not making as much as I was making in California. Of course, the cost of living is much cheaper in North Carolina. But you don't always end up making a bunch more money going into human medicine, I guess, would be my first piece of advice. So do the research and really make sure that, especially in your geographical area, are you actually going to be making more money? Sometimes if you're a veterinary technician that has 10, 15 years experience, you're probably going to be making more money as a veterinary technician than you will, you know, going into human nursing, at least initially. Sure. So now the more you specialize, you know, certainly, you know, as an ICU nurse, you're going to make more money than you would just being a floor, you know, what we call a floor nurse. So the more, again, that's the same thing in human medicine. The more skilled you are, the more experience you have, the more credentials you have, the better compensated you'll be. So the reason to, if you're considering a switch, I would say, first of all, don't switch completely because veterinary medicine is awesome. And there's things we get to do in veterinary medicine that you'd never get to do in human medicine, you know? So I don't know, like central line placement, it's pretty uncommon for anybody but a physician to place a central line in human medicine. Some hospitals do have either specialized nurses or respiratory therapists who are on like an IV team. And they'll go around and place PICCs, peripherally inserted central catheters, or sometimes true central venous catheters. But for the most part, if a patient needs an emergent central venous catheter, it's going to be the emergency physician or the ICU physician who's putting that in. So, you know, versus in veterinary medicine, God, you know, the ICU veterinary technicians, they're putting those in all day, every day. So that's one thing that, you know, and that's just one example, of course. But so you might think that human medicine is going to be more exciting, but talk to any veterinary technician who's gone into human medicine and they'll tell you, like, veterinary technicians have a much wider scope than any nursing staff member or respiratory therapist or whatever you're going to decide to get into. I mean, I did it, so, you know, I can't, and I guess the reasons, again, that I initially went back to school for it was mostly to utilize the knowledge in veterinary medicine, but inevitably, you know, just the toys and the high acuity patients are what have moved me towards the human side, but we often consider, as we look at job opportunities for myself or my wife's an emergency veterinarian. So as we look at job opportunities for her and for me, we often consider, you know, either locations or places of work that would be dealing with much higher acuity patients, either in a university setting or something, where I would be more than happy to and would love to get back into a full-time veterinary position. We just haven't found that unicorn spot yet, but there's many, many, many potentials. And I'm sure, at some point, either in the near future or distant future, I'll be back full-time in veterinary medicine. But I wouldn't leave either field completely ever.
Sure. Well, it sounds like in what we're dealing with right now with COVID, it sounds like you are a more valuable employee in the human world than you are in the veterinary world right now.
Yeah, I mean, yes, just because of sheer shortage of staff members. I mean, it's, I think that the veterinary staff members who are still seeing true emergencies, and I'm only briefly going to get on my soapbox here, but you know, there's lots of clinics that have decided to, you know, still see either regular appointments or non-urgent or emergent matters, and I think we really, as the AVMA has put out guidelines for, really need to not be seeing any non-urgent or emergent cases. You know, I think the wording AVMA has used is elective. And that's such an ambiguous word. So I really would love if the AVMA would either use different terminology or clarify what they mean by that. Because, you know, somebody, I don't know if you guys have been involved in some of these Facebook posts, but, you know, there's some people that are considering toenail trims, you know, non-elective. And like, you know, because then the toenails will ingrow and then they come in with a bleeding part. And it's like, okay, yeah, well, I get that. But a toenail trim is elective. Let's face it.
Yeah.
So I think that the people who are still out there in the veterinary world, on the front lines right now, working in the clinics are equally as important. You know, I'm a big One Health person. So I think those people who are out there deserve equal amounts of respect and encouragement and gratitude, because they're out there putting their lives on the line in the same way, and they just need to make sure they're being careful as well. I just really, obviously, if we have to decide if we, you know, treat a veterinary patient or a human patient, if there's only one set of gloves, one mask, and one gown left, you know, ethically speaking, we probably should use that PPE for the human patient. Some people would disagree with that because they hate humans, but but that's the biggest issue, is it's really just the PPE thing. And really, in order to be seeing veterinary patients right now, you should be using PPE and being really careful. And unfortunately, there's just such a severe shortage of that right now that you should just be minimizing the number of patients you have to see if at all possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Even just to save on the PPE.
Exactly. Exactly. That's all it is. It's really just a PPE concern.
Yeah. Noah, my last question for you would be, as a respiratory therapist, is there different levels to that? In other words, like, can you advance your certification any, or once you're a respiratory therapist, you're a respiratory therapist? And I mean, obviously you can expand your knowledge and your skill set, but is there any sort of like advancement in that subset of the human world?
Yeah. So the National Board for Respiratory Care is our credentialing organization, and they have always had, well, not always, but they have had two levels of credentialing, the CRT, which is a certified respiratory therapist, and the RRT, which is the registered respiratory therapist. So the way they do the exams is you take an exam, and it's a written exam, multiple choice. And that exam, if you pass, earns you the credential of the certified respiratory therapist. And then you take an additional exam that's involves clinical simulations. And if you pass that exam, you obtain the credential as a registered respiratory therapist. Historically, that meant in order to work in an ICU, they really wanted you to have your registered respiratory therapist credential, and those with the certified respiratory therapist credential, the CRT, they were doing, I don't want to say lower level work, but lower acuity patients, dealing with them, and which would just be, again, the medicated aerosol stuff, oxygen therapy, things like that. More and more now, hospitals just aren't hiring certified respiratory therapists, CRTs. In order to get a job, you really, truly have to have your RRT. And even then, you know, it's just like nursing or veterinary technology. Entry-level degree is a two-year degree, but nursing, really, to get a job right now, you have to either have a four-year degree or be pursuing a four-year degree. And it's the same thing with respiratory therapy. And I am an advocate for a four-year degree for veterinary technicians. I know some people aren't, so I would... I see some veterinary technology moving. Oh, hi. some veterinary technology programs are now really pushing that four-year degree thing, which I love. So that's one. So that's the initial, I guess, hierarchy with initial credentialing. From there, the National Board for Respiratory Care has additional specialty credentials that you can obtain, similar to a VTS, and that would be one of them being adult critical care, which is what I moved into and specialized in. But they also have neonatal pediatric respiratory care. They have sleep disorders for as a specialty certification, asthma education. So there's several different things you can kind of niche into and specialize in to work in a specific area of respiratory care. As far as like job advancement, it's somewhat limited, sort of like veterinary technology. There's, you know, you're either working clinically or you're a supervisor or a manager. That's really mostly, you know, I think the last 5-10 years, we now have, you know, people who are doing consulting and people who are doing education and people who are doing, podcasts. And so there's lots of different ways that, that people are getting creative. And it's the same thing in respiratory care. You know, there's people who are doing consulting and certainly you could move into education and management and things like that. So there's, but for the most part, it's a clinical profession. So you're either working clinically or you're doing something that's less exciting.
Got it. Thank you.
Well, no, I think that was an amazing question and answer session with you. I feel like we learned a lot. I hope our listeners learned a lot as well. We're not going to take up too much more of your time, but thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was fantastic. This was probably one of our better episodes because I feel like we learned a lot about what you do and about what's going on with COVID right now. So this has been really great. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah. And it sounds like it might be playtime for you before too long.
Yeah, exactly.
It's always playtime.
But before we let you go, I don't know how much of our episodes you've listened to. We like to ask our guests a random would you rather question at the end. So are you ready for your would you rather?
I'm ready.
Would you rather wake up in the middle of an unknown desert or wake up in the middle of some unknown body of water in a rowboat? And why?
Ooh. Some unknown body of water in a rowboat or a desert. I guess the rowboat. I am not a big fan of heat. So especially in the California heat is one thing. For the for those of you listening from the West Coast, you know, the heat on the West Coast is totally different than the heat in the Southeast. God, I just can't stand the heat down here and the humidity. And the bugs are so much worse here than they are in California. So, of course, the desert would be dry heat. But overall, I'm not a huge fan of heat. I much prefer the cold. You can always put clothes on and you can only take so many clothes off. So I'd probably choose the rowboat.
And even though there's no land in sight.
Even though there's no land in sight, because you know what? You'll float somewhere eventually, right? Even if you don't know where you're going, you're going to float somewhere eventually.
That's true. In the desert, you're not going anywhere unless you find
some water.
That's a good point. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. That was a great answer. Jeff, what would you do?
I would have also do the rowboat. I feel like there's at least some opportunity. Maybe a fish would jump in my boat that I could eat. again, probably not clean, but there's at least some water that I could, you know, drink and sustain me for a little while. I just feel like there's more options in the rowboat.
Yeah, you know, initially I thought that I wouldn't want to be in the rowboat because fish would be my only option for food, and I really don't like eating fish. But thinking about the fact that if you're in the desert and exposed to the sun, you're going to die of heat exposure a lot quicker than you would.
Would you rather eat cactus or eat fish?
Cactus.
Really? Wow, you hit fish that bad.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm not. Anyone that knows me knows I'm not a big fan of fish at all.
All right, Noah. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate all the awesome knowledge you gave us, and thank you so much for taking some time out and talking about all this with us, especially with what's going on. It's awesome, awesome, awesome stuff. I think our listeners are really going to like it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be here, guys. I appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good
one. Talk to you later.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Bye. Thanks, everybody, for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Hope you enjoyed our interview with Noah Jones, and hope everybody is well out there. Again, as Noah said, be smart in your hospitals. Be safe.
You know, and wash your hands.
Wash your hands. Really toe that line of what is and what is not essential. And, you know, we can all, you know, it's a struggle every day. We just make the best decisions that we can for our patients and our clients and our practices. And, you know, whatever you guys decide that is, just be mindful and save that PPE and practice that PPE and just do the best you can. And we hope you guys are safe and are well. So have a great day from the Vet Tech Cafe.
Bye guys.
Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.